The people of God are forever fleeing to Egypt and escaping from it. And when they are not doing either of these, they are negotiating an allegiance with Egypt for protection against some other threatening power around them. Remember when Assyria was looming on the horizon? King Hezekiah aligns himself with Egypt. Isaiah, of course, says this won't work. But Egypt woos many suitors, and Israel falls prey. A century later, Egypt comes calling again, this time offering to the people of God protection from Babylon. And only Jeremiah seems to recall that previous calamity orchestrated through an alignment with Egypt. And then, sure enough, this story ends much the same way. Yet even in those horrendous scenes of deportation and murder of the royal family, Jeremiah is smuggled away under the cover of darkness and hidden from danger in where else? Egypt. So it goes that Egypt is laced throughout the history of God's people. We should not be surprised then to find God's own son, the baby Jesus, set down for a time in the land of Egypt. Egypt lives in all of us, representing at once both captivity and protection. It signifies a time when we know just what we need to know and nothing more. Protection from the harsher realities of life. And yet it is also finally a place where we cannot stay, or else if we stay there, we will die. The children of Israel, brought there to avoid starvation and death, might have thought they would stay there forever, and yet when they finally left some 400 years later, they carried out with them Joseph's bones, the first among them to have ever ventured into Egypt. Even Joseph did not stay forever. Jeremiah did die there, and his bones did remain there. But always, Jeremiah considered his sojourn only captivity and never protection. When I was 19, maybe 20 years old, a college sophomore, the world lay at my feet in those days. There was nothing that I couldn't do, and it wasn't just because I hadn't picked a major yet and so had all possibilities remaining. There really was nothing I couldn't do because the world was wide open. There was nothing I didn't know, maybe a little calculus and some Latin verb declensions, but nothing essential for making my way through life. Either I would go here and do this, or I would go there and do that. The world was a palette of stark contrast. No gray, no ambiguity, no indecision. I knew all I needed to know for success and hopefully for prosperity. I think I was in Egypt. Now, the funny thing about Egypt is, while it is predictable, no gray, no ambiguity, no indecision, Egypt isn't always what we want, and it isn't for very long what we really need. I must say that I am glad to have moved on beyond my sophomore year in college and escaped from the burden of knowing everything. Have you any idea how hard it is to always be right? On the other hand, there's nothing to be afraid of when we know everything. And it is only when we get out of Egypt that we know enough to be scared. So Egypt is at once the shelter of not knowing, the captivity of ignorance. It's possible that some of us have never been to Egypt. We only wished for that place or imagined a time of innocence that never really existed. For most of us, though, it is real. A time in our lives when we didn't know what we know now. We didn't know, for instance, that styrofoam would destroy the ozone layer, We knew Styrofoam was efficient. We knew it was sanitary, and it is still to this day the best way to drink a cup of coffee at the office, to say nothing of the church coffee hour. Too bad we didn't know about that ozone problem. We didn't know that in Egypt. We know that burning fossil fuels, gas for our big, inefficient vehicles, pollutes the environment with far-reaching ramifications, even destroying the trees on the top of Mount Mitchell. And yet gas is cheaper now than it's been in decades. Why wouldn't we all drive big trucks or flashy sport cars? Too bad. We now know about the dying trees, which contribute to the dying wildlife, which contribute to the dying streams, which contribute to, well, you get the picture. We didn't know that in Egypt. Once we know about the styrofoam and once we know about the leaded gas, we have to make choices. We have to choose whether or not to use this product, and our choice says something about the kind of people that we are. When we are still in Egypt and didn't know any better, our consumption wasn't a reflection on our character, but now it is. Now, our ignorance no longer protects us. Leaving Egypt is hard, even when staying would be worse. With their feet still caked by mud from the brick-making enslavement of Egypt, the children of Israel stood on the banks of the Red Sea and cried to Moses, "Take us back! Take us back to Egypt!" They didn't even ask if there might be time to wash their feet first. Much uncertainty awaits us outside of Egypt, along with many choices bathed in ambiguity. The children of Israel already knew how to make bricks. They did not know how to swim. It never occurred to them that they might not have to swim. You see, an essential ingredient for life outside of Egypt includes the eyes of faith. In the wintertime, about this time of year, you can travel to the top of Paris Mountain, which is a little rise in the ground that overlooks Greenville, South Carolina. And as you look back toward the downtown area, you will notice individual clusters of communities which form a crescent around the northwest edge of that city. These crescents, these clusters, are all on the other side of the railroad tracks from the downtown area. They are on the other side of the Reedy River for the most part, although the river does wind through them on its way to the center of downtown. And each community, each cluster, is itself gathered around a huge brick edifice that rises up from the middle of that community. Leading from this focal point are streets lined with houses carefully placed and spaced to maximize their numbers. Because the streets are accented with huge oak trees and maple trees, all of this is much clearer to you in the winter months. Other things become clear as well, most notably the padlocks on the front door of the mill. These communities are mill villages, and a half century ago, they were bustling neighborhoods with their own local heroes and legends. Shoeless Joe Jackson grew up at Brandon Mill. Each mill community has their own legend, their own hero, their own stories that they can tell. Children played in the streets with abandon in those days because the future for those children was guaranteed. As you well know, the textile industry has lost its luster and the mills have laid off thousands. Yet the truth is, even before that, change was in the air. Children with job security hardwired into their very existence grew up and went off to college instead of staying home and taking the jobs their parents had held. They moved away from the village. The houses were sold, usually to absentee landlords who rented them to people that didn't know the pipes aren't supposed to freeze in the wintertime. They were just glad to have pipes. They were glad to have running water in the summertime. The churches in these communities, paragons of virtue and respectability, now surrounded by decadence and, in many cases, immorality, the churches all shrank. Some congregational remnants pulled up their stakes and, forsaking even their names in order to become something new, they chased off after their progeny into the suburbs. The faith communities who stayed behind continued to wane, eventually padlocking their own doors when the last few members became too old to venture out at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. This pattern swept across the West Crescent of Greenville like falling dominoes. The churches shut down one by one, sold their buildings, changed their names, and moved away, except for one. One of the original mainline churches in a typical West Side village stayed put. Few of its members even lived in the village any longer. None of them were particularly wealthy or prestigious, and altogether, when they all showed up on the same Sunday, they barely totaled 75. But they did a rather extraordinary thing. They invited children to come to church. Not their children, not even their grandchildren, but the children living around the church, the children who had never been to church. Before you wax sentimental about how, oh, this is the church at its best, compassionate, welcoming, embracing, and loving, let me tell you what happened when those children came to church. First of all, most of them couldn't read, much less follow along in a bulletin that contained strange words like doxology and Gloria Patri. They couldn't sing songs that started with the phrase immortal, invisible. So they did what all children do who are caught in a situation they don't understand and which isn't particularly fun. They misbehaved. And those few church members who weren't so sure about this idea in the first place took that as their cue to end the experiment. All of these things took time, of course. It took time to coax those children into the church in the first place, and it took time for the children to realize that worship can be boring. In the meantime, many of them did learn to sing the doxology, to say the Lord's Prayer, to look up the Apostles' Creed in the back of the hymnal while the adults around them recited it from memory. Some of the children aspired to become acolytes, and they did become acolytes, but the handwriting was on the wall. For this congregation, the wilderness proved too unpredictable, and eventually the children left, and the church went back to Egypt, where they are dying. Joseph loved Egypt, not the Christmas Joseph, not Mary's husband Joseph, but that other Joseph, the Joseph of the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. He loved Egypt. Of course, with 10 older brothers, crazy jealous, ready to leave you for dead at the bottom of a well and would have, save for the opportunity to make a little money off your hide when a caravan of slave traders passed by, with all that going on, who wouldn't love to be someplace else, any place else? Why not Egypt? Joseph did well in Egypt. His family did well there in spite of their original malevolent intentions toward him. Centuries rolled past, 400 years, as I said earlier. The work was hard, yes, the pay was low, but no one wanted to leave. God had to call them out of Egypt so they wouldn't die. It is a scary thing to be called away from Egypt. When we were called away on September the 11th, just a few months ago, We didn't know the world was such a dangerous place. Most of us did not know that. We knew that it could be dangerous in other places. We knew that it could be violent. But we didn't know that it was so callous, that it was so indiscriminate, that it was so fragile. Other people knew what had been kept secret from most of us. The people on the West Bank of Gaza knew. The refugees from Kosovo knew. The political parties of Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis, they knew, but we didn't. We were still in Egypt. And who among us would not like to go back there? Jesus went to Egypt. He was taken there for his own protection, to avoid, for the time being at least, the inevitable. And if you were here on Christmas Eve, or any other church for that matter, you heard that most familiar rendering of the Christmas story, the story of Mary and Joseph making their way to Bethlehem so Joseph could pay taxes, and you remember the birth of the baby in a stable, this place offered to them out of the generosity of an innkeeper's heart. It is a story of angels singing in the night and shepherds welcomed into town, common decency displayed all around. Nothing bad happens. The same cannot be said for today's story, filled with deceit and murder and escape. After hearing me explain these very separate traditions of the Luke and the Matthew Christmas narratives, someone asked me once, well, which one is true? Either the Holy Family journeyed to Bethlehem to pay taxes, where Jesus was born, and then they returned home to Nazareth, or they already lived in Bethlehem, and they fled from there to Nazareth after a detour through Egypt. Details only. Both of the stories are true, but they are true primarily for reasons far beyond historical accuracy. They're true because they tell us something about our reaction to the unimaginable revelation that God is incarnate in the life of a child born in Bethlehem and raised in Nazareth. Some of us who hear this news react with praise and thanksgiving, like shepherds summoned to his cradle by angels singing in the night. Nothing could be more diametrically opposed than pungent, untidy shepherds and radiant, melodious angels. The scene is reminiscent of a wolf living with a lamb, a leopard lying down with a kid, a calf and a lion together, or a child playing over the hole of an asp. Remember, we had been told that it would be this way. Others do not react with such delight. In the case of Herod, Scripture paints for us the picture of someone unwilling to believe God's promises, someone afraid of losing power and ready to defend his position regardless of who suffers. A person who will execute three of his own sons for fear they might usurp his throne will surely kill all the toddlers in a neighborhood of innocent strangers. And so Jesus was taken to Egypt. He might have stayed there. Who knows what would have happened if Herod had only lived a little longer, allowing Joseph to establish a thriving cabinet trade, put down roots. But Herod dies after only a few months, and just as an angel warned Joseph to flee with the child and his mother into Egypt, now an angel beckons him to leave it. Jesus is brought forth from Egypt by parents who cared about little else in the world beyond the safety of this child. Do you think that Mary would have gone home if she could have seen into the future? No. No mother would. Any of us would rather die in Egypt than watch our children suffer. But God is not with us in Egypt, where false security insulates us and ignorance enslaves us. When the people lounging in Egypt refuse to get up and heed God's call, God will move on like a pillar of fire by night and a pillar of cloud by day. God will move away from Egypt out here, where the unknown confronts us and confuses us and confounds us. God will move out here, and God will leave behind those who refuse to follow. Like Joseph bearing his bundle forth from Egypt, we do follow. We are able to move forward because Mary and Joseph did leave Egypt with that child. That child, his name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. Not with us in Egypt, but here, in this life. Here where we choose whether we will make bricks or not make bricks. Where we choose if we will welcome the children into our churches or not welcome them. Where we choose how much of the world's resources to consume for our own use and how much to leave behind for the generations who follow us. Where we choose every day what kind of people we will be. His name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. God with us out here, where we are called to be, where we choose to live, or whether to go back to Egypt. Amen.